When the kitchen opened as an experimental performance space in 1971, it was hard to imagine that the kind of work it produced would ever have a mass audience. But last year, Marina Abramovich's retrospective, The Artist Is Present, attracted a 500,000 people to the Museum of Modern Art to view many of her performance pieces reprised and for the chance to sit across from the famous artist. And for a moment at least, performance art was transformed from fringe art form to tourist attraction. A new exhibition called The View from a Volcano, The Kitchen Soho Years, 1971 to 85, on view at The Kitchen until August 27th, gives credit where credit is due and showcases the work of a broad array of videographers, dancers, performance artists, and musicians who have challenged and energized the New York art scene. One of them is Eric Boghossian, who returns to our show now, along with The Kitchen's executive director and chief curator, Deborah Singer. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks, Leonard.
Deborah, was there anything like The Kitchen before it got started? The downtown art scene was pretty open to experimentation in the 70s, wasn't it?
Well, The Kitchen was founded as an artist collective originally in 1971. It was such a vibrant time in Soho, so The Kitchen was one of many sort of artist-run organizations that were starting. So it was in an array of downtown. You could think of Artist Space or White Columns and a whole number of other places, Franklin Furnace, that all started between, let's say, 1969 and 1973. It was a sort of blossoming, burgeoning movement.
But was it doing something different than the others?
Well, The Kitchen had an interesting mission that was a little maybe more distinct and focused at the beginning than the other organizations. It was actually founded by video artist Woody and Stana Vasulka, along with a few of their friends, at a moment when video art was actually an unusual, strange phenomenon. It was not accepted by museums or shown in galleries, and so video artists said, hey, we're going to, start a space for ourselves. And similarly, they were friends with some musicians who were experimenting and also didn't have a place in uptown concert halls, and at that moment, not really in too many downtown clubs. So they also opened it up to some young musicians to also present, concerts of their work to basically their friends in the neighborhood.
And they decided to call it a performance space, even though video art was key to it. I'm not sure that's
originally it was a center for video and music. So the word performance actually came a few years later.
Yeah, it started at the old Mercer Hotel, which collapsed or something, in the kitchen of the hotel. That's where they kept all the equipment. Then moved down to Broome Street, and the loft on Broome Street was just so big and beautiful, and this was in the days when, people were discovering lofts.
And Soho.
Yeah, and Soho. It was when I started working there in the mid-70s, there was nobody down there. The streets were empty, no cars, if you can imagine that. But then performance art showed up, and it was a perfect place to do performance art. And people like Joan Jonas and Laurie Anderson and people like that were doing stuff, Vito Acconci. And then I brought in dance in 1977, and then we started having dance concerts there. So it became this, and the music was the perfect – basically everything we did there, everything but theater was – kind of what we did.
How did you wind up doing dance there? I've always associated you with voice.
As an actor, I trained in dance classes, and I got to know a lot of dancers, and I liked them. And I took something that was brand new at the time called contact improvisation, which was becoming this cool thing. And one of my teachers came by one day and saw the loft and said, this is a great loft. Why don't you guys, David Woodbury, he said, why don't you do concerts here? And I asked the boss if we could do concerts, Robert Stearns, and it took off. It happened to be 77 when there was this huge boom in dance in New York, and we put on Bill T. Jones and Carol Armitage and Melissa Fenley and all these
people who went on to become very famous afterward.
But yeah, I'm very proud of that.
Well, you came in after The Kitchen had already established itself. So did you first discover it as an audience member?
I was a student. I worked there as sort of an intern to start out, and I met these guys, and then I asked them if I could have a job, and they gave me a job for $100 a week or something, and that was and 1 year later I was running the place because everybody left.
So, Deborah, was it fairly common to hire people like Eric, whose background is in theater, as he says, to program pieces outside of his discipline?
Well, I mean, Eric can speak to his youth in terms of like what he was finding out what his disciplines were. But
although
it
he
was
suggests it's because he came cheap.
Well, one of the distinctive characteristics of the Kitchen's early history is that it was really artists who were curating other artists, either inside or outside of their discipline. You know, everything was so interconnected and such a small, vibrant scene. But I think part of what makes the Kitchen's early history so, you know, impressive is really the sort of prescient views and opinions of artists, that artists are always so sensitive to what's new, what is distinctively new happening now. And so they made such amazing choices, whether it was Rhys Chatham as a music curator or Eric as a dance curator or Arthur Russell. I mean, there's an amazing number of composers, for example, who were the music curators, you know, just doing programming that really has stood the test of time.
But it's also my sense that this was the interdisciplinary aspect came out of the fact that people knew people. The Vasulkas, for example, were friends with musicians, so they invited musicians.
Oh, it was a community for sure. We were all friends. And we also, not until 80 did we think anybody was coming to see anything that was happening there from outside our community. We were making work for ourselves, and I think that gives a lot of strength to the work. You make the stuff that you think is fun.
And you weren't getting much press? Now the New York Times would probably jump on it.
Every once in a while we'd get a little piece in the Times, and the next day we'd be overwhelmed. We wouldn't know what to do with all the people. We'd often have like a guy named Demi who used to play piano in the nude. I mean, I remember his concert. He had eight people sitting out there in the loft watching this guy. We had a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun.
Well, because you came from theater, but you were at the Kitchen, did that encourage you to play with other mediums?
I played with my theater work. When I entered that scene, the world didn't know much about theater, that world, and I didn't know much about performance art. So I would watch what they were doing. I said, this is actually kind of a rudimentary form of theater, and I ended up making pieces in that context that were theater pieces. It definitely expanded my boundaries as a theater artist, but they didn't know I was a theater guy. They didn't even know I knew how to act or anything. I was in somebody's piece one day, and they were like, wow, you're really good. It's like, yeah, well, whatever. We don't have to get into that. But it was just fun round the clock. We were, you know, a big part of it is how young we all were. We were all like 24 years old, and we just did whatever we thought was a blast. The Talking Heads did their first concerts there. I mean, it was a lot of fun.
I'm talking with Eric Bogosian, who got his start, in effect, at the Kitchen, and with Deborah Singer, who has curated a show called The View from a Volcano, The Kitchen Soho Years, 1971-1985. She is also the executive director of the Kitchen. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're talking with Deborah Singer about a new exhibit called The View from a Volcano, The Kitchen's Soho Years, 1971 to 1985, on view at the Kitchen that is no longer at the old Soho location. She is not only the curator of the show, but also the executive director of the Kitchen. And Eric Bogosian is here. He is one of the artists who really got his start at the Kitchen. So many did. Now, you were in the hotel kitchen. The hotel fell down. Moved to the space that people came to know you at. Why did you leave that space?
Well, in 1985, the Kitchen actually moved to Chelsea. You know,
with all the art galleries.
Well, there were. You know, the Kitchen was a pioneer. I mean, there was really Dia Art Center there. And that was about it. It was not the art center, the Chelsea Arts District, that you think of it today. So in 1985, the Kitchen moved to a black where we are today, which it really has a black box theater. So there's the kind of work you can do in a loft space, and then there's you get a little more ambitious, more space, more toys to play with. And so it became a whole other sort of capability of what kinds of theater and performance you could produce in a real black box as opposed to a loft space with, for example, a lot of columns.
But it strikes me as a way of running away from the crowds. Because you went to Soho when nobody went to Soho, and then people started complaining that everybody was going to Soho. At that point, you left Soho and went to Chelsea where nobody was going. Now you're stuck in Chelsea where pretty much anyone who wants to see art has to go, and now you have the High Line on top of it all.
Yeah. I'm not sure if we feel stuck in Chelsea. I mean, the directors of that time did an amazing thing. They actually bought a building, so we have really loved being there.
Now, why do you think nobody was paying much attention in the early years? Was it the nature of the work that was being presented, or just simply that people had a different concept of what was important to talk about?
You mean in terms of the small audiences in Soho for what the
No, I'm talking about the fact that you didn't get much press. I'm thinking about all of the attention that Cy Twombly is getting today, which he should be getting. But I suspect that 20 years ago, the Times would have had a nice little thing about him and not much else.
Well, if you think about it, I mean, The Kitchen was presenting new artists that while we recognize so many of those names now, we didn't back then. And, you know, if I sent you to a small space in Bushwick, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Today, you know, there's that same DIY aesthetic that was of The Kitchen in the 70s that exists in sort of, you know, more of the outer reaches of Brooklyn now that maybe, you know, I'm not sure how much the press is always covering what's out there now, too. But that's the next new thing way out there. You know, The Kitchen's more grown up now.
And well, we liked being underground. I mean, that was the in the East Village and in down in Soho, and was the fun of it was that nobody knew about us. We were able to hang around, and we also the goal was to do the craziest stuff you could think up. So again, nobody was thinking like commercial or we're going to have a run. I remember Laurie Anderson doing the same show like three times in a row, and that was a real groundbreaking event because people didn't do that. They just kind of made up crazy stuff.
Was your definition of dance more expansive than others might have had?
Oh, I had a mandate. I had an agenda as the dance person there because I was getting really sick of where experimental dance was going. It had become so fuzzy and warm and uninteresting, I thought. I liked it, but I wanted to see dance getting up on its feet again and with some power and with energy and with music. They hadn't been using music for years. And so I sought out very energetic choreographers, and I hit a motherlode with, you know, Bill and Carol and Melissa. All these guys were bringing in very highly charged dance, and it was a very exciting time.
Well, someone like Joan Jonas, who was a you mentioned earlier, kitchen artist, uses dance in some of her pieces, but she's usually categorized as a performance artist.
Yes.
So was the line blurred between performance art and dance?
Sometimes. I mean, I put on a wonderful choreographer named Johanna Boyce, who everybody was nude during the performance. So I guess that somehow puts you into, it was dance, but it was about natural movement, and it was a really fun piece. I always just thought, if the artist has a complete idea of what they're going to do, let's do that. And also The Kitchen, which Deborah and I were talking about before we came in here, has always been about supporting young artists and saying to them, do whatever you want to do. We don't care about you winning or losing or failing or anything. Come in and do your thing. And I think the results are obvious. You were talking about
I was talking about how exciting it is even today. You know, we're not quite at that sort of DIY aesthetic that it started at. We have another level of capability, but it's so exciting when you see an artist that you commission a new work. For example, an exciting young playwright, Youngjin Lee, today, a few years back, did a show called The Shipment, which was a huge success at The Kitchen, which is nice for The Kitchen, but what is so exciting really is that it brought her other opportunities to go off and grow in different ways.
Eric, your work in the exhibit includes monologues that led to your one-man shows in which you inhabited different characters. Did your experience at The Kitchen encourage you to start writing your own material?
Yes, it was. It started out meeting some guy, David Warlow from Mabu Mines. They were visiting the kitchen. I was talking to him about how to practice my voice, and he said, make tape recordings of your voice and listen to it. I made the tape recordings. While I was doing it, I was building these characters, and then I started playing the characters. Then one day I was saying, well, and then an agent came from William Morris, and he's still my agent to this day, and he said, I want to sign you. And I said, great, I get to act in things. He goes, no, I want to sign you as a writer. I said, I'm not a writer. He said, you wrote these monologues, didn't you? Then you're a writer. And thus began my career as a writer. But
of very dark characters.
All kinds of stuff. I've written everything at this point. I mean, movies, TV, all kinds of stuff, but a lot of plays. But I like to find out, you know, that's the thing about the kitchen. We don't make definitions. We say, go where it leads you and find out.
Well, you say you have said you don't consider yourself a performance artist.
Absolutely,
even though you're
not, yes,
often labeled one.
Well, I used to be. I think at this point, ever since Law and Order, I think I now have a new label. But performance art is performance made by visual artists, and I was always a theater guy. So I'm in a sort of a natural theater to Law and Order bandwidth.
One of the things that it really comes out in the exhibition in terms of what Eric was saying is also how each of these artists helped one another in different work. So you might see a Carol Armitage performance and Eric curated it, but then you see in Carol's piece that Rhys Chatham did the music, or Charles Atlas, who's a filmmaker, did the costumes, but then you can see Charles Atlas's video and Carol's dancing in the video, or another video artist's work and Eric is acting in it. So it's, you know, you really get a sense of these downtown communities of artists, a much smaller scene. And it's also amazing. At the opening, we had many people come who are of that generation, like, oh, I remember this. Look at this photo. But what was fascinating to me is a whole group of younger people, much younger than I am, coming and being amazed. Like, I can't believe this, you know, Vito Acconci was one week and Meredith, you know, Monk was the other. At the same time, you were having a Dara Birnbaum exhibition. I mean, it was literally like week after week. You couldn't believe all these things would be juxtaposed.
Well, you mentioned that you're no longer a do-it-yourself type place. Can the kitchen still introduce new and experimental artists now that it's become an institution?
Well, we're definitely an institution and not exactly like that DIY. I wouldn't say, you know, we're still not Lincoln Center. We're like, whatever that one step is above DIY, that's where we're at. Because it always feels with the artists that we're still co-producing, you know, with them in many different ways. So, and there's different levels of emerging, and trying to build an audience base for an artist is always, you know, a difficult thing and something we strive to do.
And you have developed a lot of loyalty because many of the people who had their debuts or became well-known as a result of the connection to the kitchen keep on coming back.
Yeah. I mean, it is a kind of a good karma place. I mean, because it has such a special history, it sort of breeds a devotion, which is really wonderful to see among artists. And I think that's because in the early years, many artists were the curators. I think that's at the heart of it.
You mentioned Talking Heads earlier. A lot of different kinds of musicians. Beastie Boys performances included in the exhibit. That came as a surprise. Less surprising, of course, was Laurie Anderson, Philip Glass, or Steve Reich. I would have expected them to have been part of this.
I mean, the Beastie Boys have a new album coming out, or about to be released, or just released. But when they were at the kitchen, they were 17.
And believe it or not, the first breakdancing concert ever outside of Harlem was at the kitchen. And Sally Baines brought that one in, and that was... That blew people's mind. We didn't even know what we were looking at. These guys are spinning on the top of their heads, which today is just...
It's like 1981 or something.
Yeah, and we toured it around the country as well. I think Johnny Rotten's even performed there at one point. It's one of those crossroads places, you know, all kinds of stuff.
But today he goes by his old name. What is it, John Lydon?
Johnny Lydon. Because maybe that's what he...
Well, because the kitchen has changed. The Vasilkas, that was a joke. Go over very well. The Vasilkas founded the kitchen as videographers, responding to our relationship to the screen. How are contemporary artists grappling with our relationship with technology now?
Well, you know, it's interesting to look at some of the early video work that Woody and Stana Vasilka did, and their interest in experimenting with the electronic image and different kinds of abstract imagery. And, you know, you can see that not in the same same ways today, whether it was Gary Hill or Bill Viola, really experimenting with the camera. There's a lot of early work from that time that's performance-based video in all kinds of ways. And then you could take a counterpart today, like Ryan Tricarton, who has this astonishing show on Vue now at PS1, who is really kind of, you know, breaking the rules of what video art could be, what installation could be, what can video online in an internet experience. I mean, he is a young person who's a complete YouTube generation making work for very consciously for an internet audience. At the same time, it can be experiential in a museum space. So there are these relays between, you know, young people today, how they're experimenting with technologies. Then looking back now, it's an interesting time to do so.
Do you see other places being influenced by the kitchen? The new museum, for example.
Well, you know, what's so interesting, the kitchen is such a small space, but because of the early performers there doing it first, it's actually very influential on a European scene. There's still so many European presenters that come and see what the kitchen is doing.
Well, your address?
Oh, the kitchen is at 512 West 19th Street between 10th and 11th Avenues.
And the exhibit is The View from a Volcano, The Kitchen, Soho Years 1971 to 1985. Thank you both so much for being with us, Deborah Singer and Eric Bogosian.
Thanks, Leonard.